This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, October 27, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, protesters respond to police force at Occupy Oakland. In Egypt, activists condemn a 7-year sentence for the police that killed blogger Khalid Saeed. And lawmakers question the U.S. role in Pakistan and Afghanistan and the billions being spent each month. Those stories and more. First, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. The 15-member UN Security Council voted today to end international military action in Libya. On Monday, the no-fly zone will be lifted, as well as civilian protection measures. Despite some member concerns that international military action in Libya expanded beyond the UN mandate, U.S. Ambassador Susan Rice said the mission was ultimately a success.
This closes what I think history will judge to be a proud chapter in the Security Council's history and experience, where it acted promptly and effectively to prevent mass slaughter in Benghazi and other parts of the East, and to effectively protect civilians.
Libya's National Transition Council announced today it would investigate and try the killers of Muammar Gaddafi. This is a break from previous statements by the council, which denied that rebel forces were specifically to blame for the deposed dictator's death. Authorities at St. Paul's Cathedral, the site of the Occupy London Stock Exchange camp, are coming under increasing pressure. Today, a top-ranking official stepped down in protest of plans to remove the demonstrators. FSRN's Naomi Fowler reports from London.
The canon of St. Paul's Cathedral, Dr. Giles Fraser, had defended Occupy London's right to peaceful protest after a court injunction stopped them from setting up camp in a square nearby. But today he resigned. In a statement, he said he couldn't support the possibility of violence in the name of the church, which might be used to remove peaceful protesters. Many of the cathedral's funders are from London's financial sector, including Lloyds, Goldman Sachs, HSBC and UBS. They're some of the very institutions behind the economic injustices Occupy London's protesting. Meanwhile, the Bishop of London has offered to organise a debate between protesters, business people and politicians, if the protesters agree to shut down the camp. So far, Occupy London hasn't responded and is planning an ongoing series of events and debates of its own. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
Temperatures are falling in Turkey, creating miserable conditions for the victims of last weekend's earthquake and the rescue workers who continue to search the rubble for survivors. Some regions are receiving snow. Elizabeth Beers of the UN says supplies are still needed for the displaced.
Shelter, winterized tents, because the temperature goes below zero during the night and it's a very cold temperature, and also monitor closely the health situation.
Reported deaths now top 530. The Turkish Red Crescent told media that 17 of its supply trucks have been looted. The Thai government has ordered troops on standby to assist in evacuation and relief efforts as the capital braces for widespread flooding. Many of Bangkok's residents have fled. Shops have struggled to replenish depleted stocks of drinking water and other essentials after days of panic buying. FSRN's Ron Corbin reports.
Transport services in the city's main airport were crowded Thursday as thousands of Bangkok residents fled ahead of a massive flood tide sweeping the capital. The northern and riverside suburbs are already reported inundated with water up to 2 meters deep. Bangkok City Governor Sukhumban Pariparatha says the next 2 days are crucial as floods coincide with a high tide on the Chao Phraya River.
I think the second overflow is 3 or 4 times the volume, and we are bracing for that. Some people say that it may arrive around the 26th, and it will coincide 2 days later with a very high tide. So I think that will be the next critical moments for us.
The floods are the worst in 5 decades. More than 360 people have died, many of them children. Thousands of people are being housed in evacuation centres. Since the widespread floods began 2 months ago, some 3 million people have been affected. In addition, damage to thousands of factories has led to massive layoffs. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
And finally, a group of active and veteran gay service members, in conjunction with the Service Member Legal Defense Network, filed suit today challenging the Defense of Marriage Act. With the recent repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, gay and lesbian service members are now, in the eyes of the military, supposedly on equal legal footing as their heterosexual counterparts. But the suit charges that because of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, they and their legal spouses have been denied military benefits like identification cards, spousal health care, and survivor benefits. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The U.S. role in Afghanistan has long been controversial, with many pointing to night raids that often kill civilians. Similarly, in neighboring Pakistan, U.S. drone strikes have led to civilian deaths and sparked anger. How many civilians have been killed is unclear, and some say the officials aren't accurately keeping track. A drone strike today in Pakistan killed up to 5 suspected militants. Media coverage did not mention civilians. These policies, which are supported and carried out by the U.S. military, make America's relationship with those countries tenuous. Today, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton took questions from U.S. House lawmakers about the future of the U.S. role in those nations. Matt Laszlo reports lawmakers are growing weary of the current U.S. relationships in the region.
The United States has been in Afghanistan for more than a decade, and many lawmakers are ready to bring troops home quickly. Secretary Clinton just got back from a trip to the region. She reports U.S. forces are still on target for a withdrawal in 2014.
We have a plan that our military leadership is implementing to continue to advise and support as Afghans take the lead, but to move away from any kind of ongoing combat responsibility by American or NATO ISAF troops.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai recently made headlines by telling a television station his forces would back Pakistan if the U.S. ever got into a conflict with the country. With America spending about $7 billion a month in Afghanistan, that angered lawmakers. House Foreign Relations Committee Chair Ileana Ross-Leighton told Clinton the administration needs to do a better job applying pressure on the Afghanistan leader.
The Afghan government must be pushed to make the necessary steps to become a reliable partner for the U.S. over the long term. Too much American blood and treasure have been invested in Afghanistan for us to walk away or to have a government that threatens American interests.
In Pakistan, the U.S. is facing a more complicated reality. Lawmakers are still smarting that the mastermind of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, Osama bin Laden, spent years hiding less than a mile from the Pakistan Military Academy. Ross-Leighton says Congress can't write blank checks to Pakistan unless lawmakers witness reforms.
Our two countries are at a crossroads. We cannot sustain a partnership with Islamabad if it pursues policies that are hostile to U.S. interests and jeopardize American lives. Legislation developed in our committee and carried by the Appropriations Committee puts tough conditions on U.S. assistance to Pakistan funded through State Department accounts.
Lawmakers accuse Pakistan of allowing sanctuary for Afghan insurgents and supporting suspected terror networks. The top Democrat on the committee, Howard Berman of California, says Pakistan and Afghanistan are two inseparable problems.
We will not be successful in Afghanistan, militarily or politically, unless Pakistan plays a constructive role in allowing Afghans to determine the future of Afghanistan for themselves.
The Obama administration has temporarily halted providing military assistance to Pakistan, but it continues to send billions of dollars to Afghanistan. Rhode Island Democrat David Cicilline questions why the U.S. is spending so much money overseas while cutting projects at home.
It's a very hard thing for my constituents to understand in this difficult economy that we're investing those kinds of resources to rebuild the economy in Afghanistan when we have such urgent needs here.
But Clinton told lawmakers it's vital for the State Department to use federal aid packages to bring stability to the region.
Building capacity and opportunity in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and across the region. Now, this is part of a clear-eyed strategy rooted in a lesson we have learned over and over again around the world. Lasting stability and security go hand in hand with greater economic opportunity.
Lawmakers are currently looking to cut more than $1 trillion in spending. While Republicans are asking for a major overhaul of Medicare, progressives are calling for a complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. For now, that's something the administration won't consider. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
Across the country, outrage is growing following a police attack in Oakland, California, that left a U.S. veteran hospitalized in critical condition. Former Marine and Iraq War veteran Scott Olson was shot in the head at close range by what's believed to be a police projectile. Video of the attack shows the unarmed Olson wearing a military jacket and hat and standing passively in front of a row of heavily armed riot police. What appears to be a firecracker is shot toward police, who then return fire with what law enforcement calls non-lethal weapons. Protesters run away from the smoke, but one is left on the ground. When a number of people run to his aid, an officer fires yet another weapon, setting off an explosion and smoke directly into the group trying to help Olson. Friends and supporters, including anti-war veterans Joshua Shepard and Jason Mathern, spoke yesterday at a vigil at the scene of the attack.
My friend Scott Olson, he's a two-time Iraq War Marine veteran. He was struck in the head by a police projectile, and now he's in critical condition with bleeding of the brain. It's unclear whether he'll be in surgery or not. I just think it's absolutely unconscionable that some of our citizens can go overseas protecting our citizens, so-called protecting our citizens, just to come back and have our own police injure them.
If what you think happened to Scott last night was wrong, and you think there needs to be something that needs to be done about it, if you agree with what Scott agreed with ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and if you agree with what's going on here in the Occupy movement, then come out here and support him and support all these other people who've been on these streets for weeks and take part in this and do it peacefully with civil disobedience.
Shepard, Mathern, and Olson are members of Iraq Veterans Against the War and Veterans for Peace. Other veterans are speaking out against the violence used by police and call for vigils across the country tonight. Occupy Oakland also voted in support of a citywide general strike on November 2nd. Condemnation has even spread globally, with a group in Cairo, Egypt, planning a march to the U.S. Embassy on Friday to protest the police violence used against U.S. protesters. Meanwhile, also in Egypt, on Wednesday, an Egyptian court convicted two policemen of manslaughter and sentenced them to 7 years in prison for the killing of Khalid Said. The 28-year-old Egyptian blogger was killed in June 2010 after posting material critical of the police. Government inaction after his death helped to inspire the successful uprising that removed Hosni Mubarak from power. The sentencing is drawing criticism for its relatively light punishment and the downgrading of the conviction from murder to manslaughter. Activists are watching the case as a test for the judicial system in a post-Mubarak Egypt, now under the rule of a transitional military council. For more, we're joined by Mustafa Hussein, an Egyptian blogger and psychiatrist who has been following the case. He joins us from Cairo by mobile phone. Mustafa Hussein, welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much, and I'm glad to speak to you.
Begin by describing the response to the verdict that came on Wednesday. How are people responding to this?
The majority of people I've seen, the responses were quite upset. This is because there was a huge smear campaign and operation to dismiss this case by several government officials. This includes the head of the forensic department. This includes the media, state media, and several newspapers. And so I think that one of the feelings that people are having from this verdict is that there are so many people actually who collaborated, including actually two officers in the police stations who tried to cover up the crime, should have been included in the sentencing and should have been included in the trial in the first place. And so people feel that these people have actually escaped from justice.
And let's talk for a moment about that judicial system. Egypt is now currently under a transitional military council. There were reports of violence in the courtroom as this verdict and sentencing was being announced, with families of the policemen reacting to this verdict. What does this say about the judicial system right now?
Our judicial system right now in this transitional phase has the problem of military tribes to civilians. And this is actually one of the most important issues right now in this phase, because we have 12,000 civilians who have been tried under military courts. We don't really understand when will they stop military trials for civilians. As for the judicial, as for the normal judiciary and courts, it seems that actually the police, since the revolution began, are actually more interested in being passively aggressive, and that's by not actually doing the job of securing government buildings properly, securing other areas properly.
Well, this brings up not just the court system, but also the conduct of police. Khalid Saeed appears to have been targeted because he posted a video that appeared to show policemen after a drug bust and showed corruption. So this issue goes directly to police corruption. Talk about that sensitivity to this case and how that's played out.
To be honest, this is one of the things that makes actually Khalid Saeed one of our most important martyrs in this revolution, the one who actually everyone identified with months before the revolution started, and this is why he's very iconic and important. And the sentencing of 7 years does appear to be a very lenient sentence, and it is actually a lenient sentence to such crime and also to such figure he has become.
As a blogger yourself and someone who monitors what happens in Egypt, especially the military power there and the police, how does this affect your work there and your decisions of how to cover things and what to communicate to the public about what's going on?
Well, it's important to understand that for years and years, the police has been systematically torturing individuals in Egypt. This has been the way. It's very important to see proper sentences after the revolution, because before the revolution, it was very rare that police officers were put behind bars, and they got very, ridiculous sentences. I mean, we don't want to see, and we don't want to send this message again, the Mubarak era message, which is police officers can operate under impunity. And this is very important for the police officers to see, and for them and for the entire police and the interior ministry to seek solutions to the problem of abuse and to actually train their officers properly and to end this both unprofessional and criminal activity.
Mustafa Hussein is a blogger and psychiatrist. He joined us by mobile phone in Cairo to discuss the latest verdict in the case of Khalid Saeed, who was killed by policemen in June 2010. Mustafa Hussein, thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure.
FSRN will hold its 2011 annual meeting on Sunday, October 30th at 9:30 a.m. Pacific and 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time. This meeting will be via teleconference. You can attend by dialing 218-486-1611. The code is annual pound sign. That number again is 218-486-1611, and the code is annual, that's A-N-N-U-A-L, and then press the pound sign. For more information, visit fsrn.org. After marathon negotiations that lasted through the night, the heads of 17 countries that use the euro, plus banks and other financial institutions, have agreed on reforms they say will put the troubled currency back on firm footing. But some civil society groups see the plan as a recipe for prolonged suffering for the people of debt-ridden European countries. From France, Liam Moriarty has more.
At 4 this morning, top EU officials emerged to unveil the agreement to stabilize the eurozone. European Commission President José Manuel Barroso told reporters the plan is just what skittish financial markets want to hear.
Europe needed to deliver a comprehensive response to the sovereign debt crisis. And I believe that now we have a very solid way forward.
The plan includes a new requirement that banks increase their capital holdings to reassure financial markets of their stability. The European Financial Bailout Fund will be beefed up to backstop Italy, Spain, and other shaky economies. Also, banks and other investors who bought Greek bonds have reluctantly agreed to take a 50% loss. This will lower Greece's debt to a more manageable level, making outright default less likely. Global financial markets responded to the long-awaited deal with cautious optimism, showing modest gains. But Greek citizen Yorgos Vassalos isn't celebrating.
It's really a destructive decisions that have been made yesterday.
Vassalos is a researcher with Corporate Europe Observatory, a corporate watchdog think tank based in Brussels. He says the new plan will cause more of the pain that severe budget austerity has imposed on his country.
People in Greece have suffered income losses of around 50% in the last 2 years, and unemployment runs already above 20%.
Vassalos points to the hundreds of billions of euros that will go toward making sure banks don't collapse under the weight of bad debt. He says saving banks from the consequences of unwise investments should not be done on the backs of working people and families. Of particular concern to Vassalos is the increased supervision of the Greek government that will come from European institutions under the new plan, a development he calls deeply undemocratic.
The government that was elected by the Greek people doesn't have the power anymore in this country. It's some unelected bodies, such as the Commission or the European Central Bank, that will have the final say in all kinds of decisions.
EU officials say the previous Greek government triggered the crisis by taking on way too much debt. They say further consolidation of the economies that use the euro is the only way to prevent that and allow the currency to remain viable into the future. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
In Argentina, a federal court sentenced 12 former military officers to life in prison for crimes against humanity carried out at the ESMA Navy Mechanics School, which became one of Latin America's most notorious torture centers. More than 30,000 people were secretly imprisoned here and executed during Argentina's bloody dictatorship from 1976 to 1983. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
Outside of the courthouse, hundreds celebrated as they watched the verdict broadcast on a big screen TV. Alfredo Astiz, a lieutenant who served at the torture center, was among those sentenced to life in prison. Astiz, also known as the Blonde Angel of Death, is most notorious for infiltrating the human rights group Mothers of Plaza de Mayo and coordinating the disappearance of two of the founding mothers. As Astiz was sentenced, he gave cameras a defiant smile and pinned a patriotic colored ribbon to his suit. Enrique Fuchman is a torture survivor who was held at the ESMA. He lamented that the officers were only tried for the murder and forced disappearance of 86 people.
Today there's mixed feelings. On one side, the celebration that after struggling for so many years, next month marks 33 years ago since I was kidnapped, that we could at least reach this point, that a group of repressors who committed genocide are on trial and will be sentenced. On the other hand, I feel rage that only two repressors are today on trial in connection with my kidnapping, as if only two individuals could have carried out all the crimes.
More than 5,000 people were disappeared at the ESMA, the largest clandestine detention center that operated during the 1976-1983 military dictatorship. Many of the victims were drugged and dropped into the sea from military planes. Survivor Fuchman describes the ESMA as a nexus of terror.
I was held kidnapped at the ESMA for 18 months. For 6 months, I was hooded and tied up. The remaining time, the officers used me for slave labor. They made us work or they would kill us. ESMA is known as Argentina's Auschwitz because of the magnitude of the crimes, the amount of people that were kidnapped, tortured, and disappeared from the ESMA.
In the landmark trial investigating the crimes committed at the ESMA Navy Mechanics School, 11 other former Navy officers were convicted of kidnapping, torturing, and killing leftist dissidents. The disappearance of Susana Angarula's husband is one of the cases investigated in this trial. Her husband, Juan Carlos Anserena, was 28 when he was disappeared for his labor organizing activity at a Nestle plant in Buenos Aires.
With our struggle, we were able to take away the impunity. The officers being sentenced today enjoyed 30 years of impunity. The state had to change the laws that blocked justice for the crimes committed during the dictatorship. Today, we are seeing justice. However, only 300 officers are facing charges for abuses during the dictatorship, when that is the number of clandestine detention centers. Thousands participated in the crimes. Only the repressors who were seen by the small number who survived the concentration camps have been put on trial.
Many of the officers sentenced in the ESMA trial were indicted in the 1980s. But laws passed in the 90s protected former security personnel from charges. Even with judicial roadblocks, human rights groups continued to push for investigations into the disappearance of tens of thousands. In 2005, Argentina's Supreme Court overturned amnesty for the military. Leonel Curuchegui, one of the human rights lawyers working on the ESMA trial, says that Argentina has set legal precedent by defining the crimes committed during the military junta as systematic genocide and crimes against humanity.
The ESMA is one of the first mega trials held. Argentina should be proud of these trials because they are an example of international legal precedent. We have set an example by trying repressors when the majority of them are still alive. Argentina is one of the few countries which has recognized the forced disappearance of individuals as a crime against humanity.
The former military school was closed down in 2007 and converted into a museum documenting the crimes during the dictatorship, including the kidnapping of children born while their mothers were held captive. It is estimated that 200 babies were born at the ESMA's maternity ward and taken from their mothers. The courts are currently investigating these crimes, but so far only 8 have been charged, including former dictator Jorge Rafael Videla. FSRN, Marie Trigona, Buenos Aires.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Jane Chang and Janine Etter. Thanks to Megan LaSala for providing sound for today's newscast. FSRN is largely funded by listeners like you. More information is available on our website at fsrn.org. We always welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marino.